This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Thank you. Thank you. Camp Dietrich and other institutions have been doing biological warfare research for years. They then shut it down because of various treaties and so on. They can always start it up again. The amount of money spent on that kind of stuff is pretty small as compared to the total budget of scientific research. So at the moment, I don't see that it'll have any effect, no. Mm. Now, the kind of effect such wars have, political wars, like the war on terrorism, is to create a kind of security hysteria in which people may have to sign security, loyalty oaths, and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But as far as money is concerned, no, I don't see it.
And you actually believe that it often has not been in your particular, well, it has not been in your case that you were denied research funds because of your activities. In fact, it never happened.
But in fact,
that the kind of McCarthyite atmosphere that did exist in this Cold War period was really the work of politicians, people on boards of regents, and so on, who used it as an occasion for advantage or to go after people to succeed politically.
Yes, individuals certainly suffered. Yeah. I mean, there's no question about that.
Yeah.
People lost their jobs. People in the University of California, after the professors at the University of California swore loudly they'd never sign a loyalty oath, they did. Mm-hmm. They had no choice. But we don't live in a totalitarian society, and the system is very inefficient in that sense. And I and other people who were deeply involved in what were then regarded as, I suppose, subversive activities, continued to get funded without cessation from the Atomic Energy Commission, from the National Science Foundation, the NIH, from the Office of Naval Research. The activities of McCarthy severely hurt some people and put a lot of psychological stress on others, but it was very inefficient as a way of denying support to opponents of the state.
Mm-hmm.
Very inefficient. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, if we ever get as efficient enough to do that, we really will be living in a totalitarian state. So far, that hasn't happened.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the profiling of students because of their national origins, which seems to be part of the agenda these days, how will that impact research if it's implemented?
It's very hard to know. Will they be denied entry into the university? Will you be prohibited from hiring them? I mean, I don't know the answer. Look, during the Second World War, Japanese were very severely hurt by that.
Mm-hmm.
Profiling. And curiously enough, German refugees who had left Germany either because of political or religious persecution nevertheless were German nationals and were restricted in their movement. My piano teacher, who taught at Curtis Institute in Philadelphia, had to get special permission to come up to New York to teach his students because he happened to be a German. He was a German Jew and he left Germany. But so, yes, I mean, it does make people's lives difficult, and in some cases it makes real hardship. People lose their jobs. I mean, it's evil stuff. But to ask me whether it has a mass effect, I haven't seen the mass effect yet, and I don't know what to tell you.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were describing what you do as a scientist, one could see that the difficulty that the public might have in understanding, you know, what it is you do as a scientist. But in your writings, you're really saying that more is going on in the obfuscation of science that is a part of the landscape in the United States. And I want you to help us understand some of the social forces at work here. I think you're suggesting that some of it requires a kind of a political or sociological analysis of the community of scientists and how they fit in to national society and so on. I know that you've written a lot on the Human Genome Project and question both its goals and the way it's presented. Help us understand that problem a little.
Well, there are a lot of dimensions to it, Harry.
Yeah.
Some of them quite specific and some rather general. I don't know which to begin with. On the specific side, genetics in particular has for its entire history since the beginning of the 20th century, except for a very brief period during the period of the Second World War. Genetics has been extremely, what shall I call, deterministic in its view of the causes of human and social behavior. Geneticists have been, if you like, imperialistic in saying genes are responsible for everything. Mm-hmm. And the most violent eugenicists and in some ways racists were geneticists, who said genes dominate everything, and if there are differences between groups in how rich they are, how much power they have, it must be in the genes. Only for a short period, during the Second World War, when the consequences of that ideology in the National Socialist state in Germany became clear, did people back off that. Mm. When I was in high school during the Second World War, we got pamphlets saying, well, there really aren't any important differences between races and so on. But that disappeared when the war was over. And within 10 years of the end of the war, it had come back again. So biologists in general are biological determinists. Mm-hmm. And that has a very powerful ideological effect, because then they speak to reporters, they talk on the radio, they have TV interviews, and they push over and over again the determinism of the gene. My wife and I went yesterday to the Berkeley Art Museum, and there we saw an exhibit called Gene Genesis. Mm-hmm. And the poster for that exhibit, which is all over, has a quote from Jim Watson. Mm-hmm. And what does the quote say? It says, "We used to think our fate was in the stars, but now we know it's in our genes." Now, I mean, that's rubbish, you know. Mm-hmm. But that's what's pushed. And if you're a Nobel Prize winner like Jim, you get all the more credit for it. So scientists had that ideology that as organisms we are governed body and soul by our genes. Secondly, more broadly, scientists want to make claims for the importance of what they do in the general sense. So Jim Watson wants to say, look, you should support work on the genome, because after all, everything that's important in life is determined by genes. Mm-hmm. And that's not ideological, that's purely political. That is a crass way of trying to increase and guarantee the support of research. And the same is true for medical research. We're told over and over and over again that if we do this research, people's lives will be saved. People will be cured. Well, obviously, medical cures do arise out of some kinds of research. I mean, nobody can deny that. Mm-hmm. But promises are made of an extreme sort, which do not correspond to actual truth. I mean, this guy Hazeltine, who's the head of one of these private genome organizations, finally said what everybody wanted to say but didn't have the nerve to say. He said, death is nothing but a succession of preventable diseases. Well, if death is nothing but a succession of preventable diseases, mm-hmm. then if you give us enough money, you'll live forever. Mm-hmm. Now, no sensible person believes that. Mm-hmm. But that's the kind of appeal that it's made. Give us more power, give us more money, and we will not postpone your death. We will prevent it. Mm-hmm. Look, there are a lot of sick people in the world. Most of them are sick ultimately because they're underfed and overworked. Mm-hmm. That's not the case for Americans. Most Americans are sick because they've lived a long time and their machines are breaking mm-hmm. down. You know, the transmission goes and then you need a brake job and so on. Mm-hmm. And there's a tremendous public demand and people are in pain, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's a demand to relieve that pain and relieve that anxiety. And science cashes in on that in, I think, a very cynical way, by making promises that can't be kept.
Mm-hmm. And another way it does this, you were suggesting in your lectures, is by the metaphors it uses.
Well, that's how you do it. You do it by saying genes make the organism. Mm-hmm. And if you really believe it, genes are self-replicating, so they are powerful. They have, mm-hmm. The whole notion is that the genes inside of us are sort of independent of us. They're in there doing their work. Mm-hmm. They make new copies of themselves, and they make you, and therefore they make society. And so if you support research on them, mm-hmm. you will be able to change everything you want to change. Mm-hmm. And the metaphors are that genes make proteins, that genes are self-replicating, and so on and so forth.
Which leads, as you were suggesting in your lecture, an ignoring of the relationship of the organism to its environment.
Exactly so. Exactly so. Because the minute you allow the complication of the interaction between the gene and the environment, then it doesn't look like genes are quite so important as mm-hmm. as before. Mm-hmm. Then you have to say, well, look, let's take the case of the major killers of the 19th and 20th centuries. The major killers of the 19th and 20th centuries, up until the first decade or so of the 20th century, were certain infectious diseases. That's what killed people. Those infectious diseases were not waterborne diseases. They were airborne diseases. And a major killer of children in the 19th century was measles. Now think of that. When I was a child, everybody had measles. Everybody in my class had measles. Nobody died of it. But in the 19th century, children died of measles. The major killer of women in the 19th century was not women of childbearing age was not childbearing. It was tuberculosis. Now, why is it that tuberculosis was the major killer of people in the 19th century? The germs are still around and is now a very small fraction of the death rate. And very few people get tuberculosis now. Mm-hmm. People do, but very few relative to the population at large. And children don't die of measles. Well, now, of course, they're inoculated against measles, but nobody in my generation died of measles, although measles is still a primary cause of child mortality in West Africa. The reason is because both tuberculosis and measles are, in their severity and eventual effect, and probably of getting tuberculosis, are closely related to nutrition. Measles is a protein-consuming disease, and if you already have a severe protein deficit, as children in West Africa do, and then you get the measles, you die. If you're well fed, and measles does something, measles actually destroys protein, it consumes protein. So, you know, if you're already underfed, you're in big trouble if you get measles. But if you're well fed as I was, and as my classmates in school were, then it's just an annoyance. Tuberculosis was a chief killer during the 19th century because people were underfed. And women died more of tuberculosis than men because in 19th century industrial England, for example, where the data come from, men were better fed than women. When there was meat to be had and the man came home from the factory, the man got the meat and the women and children got what was left over. So as far as the causes of death are concerned in our society, environment, social environment, pay scales, unemployment, social attitudes toward who deserves to get fed and who doesn't have had a profound effect on the causes of mortality.
So you're suggesting that the metaphors that we choose are in part the result of the political and social dynamics within science.
Absolutely.
You know, the competition for resources and power, but that also that they reflect the broader society and the decisions about, for example, the individual versus the community or whatever dichotomies we might be talking about.
Yes, quite so. I mean, you don't want to think that the chief cause of death in your society is that people are underfed.
Right.
That's bad news. Mm-hmm. Because then people might demand that you do something about it. Instead of putting all that money into germs, you should put it into feeding people.
Mm-hmm. So then what is then the answer for the problem that you posed in your writings, namely the problem of the inadequate way the public understands what science is up to and the lack of tools to criticize?
That's a very serious problem, Harry, that I don't have a good answer to. Science reporting in newspapers, for example, and on the radio and on TV are a serious problem. They're a serious problem not because science reporters are dumb or ignorant. It's because of the nature of public media. I know a lot of science reporters. I work together, I have over the years, with the Knight Journalism Fellowships at MIT, where science journalists come to MIT and spend a year on sabbatical or 6 months on sabbatical interacting with scientists, and I have met with them often. And I've been greatly impressed with how much they know. But when it's time to write an article for the New York Times, or have 5 minutes on TV or on the radio, you are in competition with all kinds of other people who want column inches and 5 minutes on the radio. And if you don't make it dramatic, you don't get the 5 minutes. I mean, you cannot get a long column in the science-ish part of the New York Times or the news part of the New York Times if you write an article saying, well, it's all very complicated. You know, it's some of this and some of that, and we really don't know what's happening, and we're sort of trying to find out, and it's probably some environment. No editor is going to give you column inches for that. Mm-hmm. That's point one. And the result is that much of what's written for the public is obfuscating because it's overdramatic. Scientists today have found a gene which, and then you read what they say, which may one day give us information that might lead to a cure for. Mm-hmm. Now, it's always may one day might lead to. Mm-hmm. But the important, but that slips under the rug. The important thing is scientists announce today that. And of course, a great deal of what appears in the press and on the radio and on TV about the products of science are the outcome of press conferences called by the press office of the University of X, which is constantly after its professors to feed them stuff which they can then announce to the press. And then the press guy goes to the press conference, and somebody gets up and says, today we found a gene for, and so on. That's another way of getting money, of bringing, you know, if I have to deal with the state legislature and getting my budget, one of the things I'd like to do is to say people on my faculty have contributed this, that, and the other to public welfare, and if you don't believe it, look in the Los Angeles Times for last week. Mm-hmm. So there's strong social pressures on scientists to make excessive claims, and there's strong pressures on those who report science to the public to exaggerate and simplify. Not just, and look, I'm all in favor of simplifying. If a thing can be made simple, let's make it simple. Mm-hmm. But they simplify it to the extent of making it untrue, and that's the real problem.
Mm-hmm. Or simplify to the extent of furthering the interests of particular groups or companies or whatever.
To some extent, although I don't think that's the most serious issue. Yeah. The most serious issue is just going along with the metaphors and extreme inaccurate simplifications of the field just in order to be able to get it out there. Mm-hmm. I don't see most science journalists as either witting or unwitting tools of commercial interest. There may be such mm-hmm. people, but that's not our big problem.
It's a broader landscape, the way it all hangs together,
yeah.
So to speak.
Look, I have the experience of reading the science section of the New York Times once a week, the Science Times, and not understanding what the reporters are telling me. I'm a scientist. And I'm not just a biologist, I'm also a statistician. I was trained in physics as an undergraduate. I mean, I'm a pretty broad, I'm not an expert in nuclear physics, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. But I try to understand what the reporter is telling me, and I can't ever understand it.
And why is that, do you think?
Because it doesn't have the kind of logical, detailed development that I expect. You know, mm-hmm. A leads to B, B leads to C, C leads to D. No. A was discovered, and that means D. And I can't figure out the relationship between them at all.
Mm-hmm. If students were to watch this tape and they aspire to wear the both hats that you have worn very well, that of a critic of both science and a commentator on society in general, but also that of a scientist, what are there some rules that we can lay down for how one does that well without compromising?
Yeah, well,
either?
Rule one, Harry, is don't start out by being a social critic. Mm-hmm. Start out by being a scientist, because I think I said in this interview before, but I'll say it again if I haven't, that the critical issue for a social critic is legitimacy. And you don't want to be written off as some sort of loudmouth who can't do anything better than just yak. Mm-hmm. So the first thing to do is to establish real credentials as a producer of science, recognized by the science community and accepted by them as being of some value. When you stand on that base, you can then go out. Mm-hmm. The second point is that you must make it clear at all times, and it must be clear in your own mind, that the science that you do and the result, and especially not the science you do, but the results you get in your science and what you say about science cannot be shown to be simply the consequence of your social attitudes. If I say that genes and environment are important, I have to have a firm underpinning for that within the scientific apparatus. I cannot say, well, I wish that were true because I would like a world in which I could change the world, and therefore I'm prejudiced in the way I report the world. Because that's the first thing that your opponents will say. Oh, you just say that because that's your political ideology. You're justifying that political ideology by pretending that science has done that. The observations have to be there independent of any justification. You have to distinguish between why you do a thing and what the result is. It may be that you are propelled forward to study the relationship between gene and environment because you have some political agenda. But what you say better not be tainted by that. Mm-hmm. That's very tricky and very important.
And what is your advice to the general public? Because I can hear people watching this say, well, if he can't understand what's being said in the New York Times science section, you know, how can I understand? So what can people, the average person, do to be informed citizens in the debates that involve science, policies that are rationalized about science through the uses of science?
Harry, you raised there one of the most difficult social problems that exists. And I want to put it in a broader context for a moment before I come back to the specific question you're asking, because I don't know the answer to the specific question. The founding fathers of our republic said that essentially that you can't have a democratic society if you don't have an educated electorate. How can people make democratic decisions about what has to be done unless they have some education? So we have a public education system. What the founding fathers never could have imagined is the kind of knowledge that you would have to have in order to make informed decisions. Look. Let's talk about the Star Wars project. I don't know enough about physics and engineering to decide whether it would work or not. I have to trust somebody else to tell me. I don't know enough about physics to make those decisions. I have to trust what Steve Weinberg tells me. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, that is a very serious problem. I'm a scientist, and I still have to trust what other people tell me. So the problem for the public in general is that in order to make democratic decisions, you have to believe something about elite knowledge which is possessed only by a few people. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to know what to do about that. It really, I don't have a glib answer to that. It is one of the contradictions of a democratic society in a highly advanced technological world that to make rational political decisions, you have to have a knowledge which is accessible only to a very few people. And the first rule, I suppose, is if there are public disagreements among people who are supposedly equally expert, then you better be careful. I mean, if they all agree, well, you have no choice but to take what they say. I don't know what else you can do. Mm-hmm. But if there's any disagreement, then listen carefully to what those debates are about and see if you can figure out who's coming from where and why. That's true for the Genome Project and things like that. That's what killed Star Wars. Well, I don't know if that's what killed Star Wars, but that's what made the public doubtful about it. Whether that was had any effect politically, I don't know the answer. But I have no answer to the question mm-hmm. because there are no institutions of the promoting the public understanding of science that are widely available to the public that do not obfuscate the issues either by funneling them through media people who have to try to get the space in your before your eyes and in your ears, and therefore they're under control of editorial exigencies and so on, or because they're the captives of scientists who have their own agendas, so that the head of the Whitehead Institute will tell them how wonderful everything they do is because that's part of the agenda. I don't know the answer. I don't have an answer. I think the answer is listen to me.
Or at least we have to find out a way to how to institutionalize you. You said something which this will be the last question and maybe a brief answer. You really believe that. I think you said two things that I just, if you want to comment. You said men make their own history, but not as they choose.
I didn't invent that.
No, I know you. Yeah, no, I know. But it tells us where you are philosophically in your view of human nature. And then you also said to decide, it was the responsibility to decide what kind of world you want and make the decisions to move in that direction.
If you can. And that's the problem, because the latter one, yes, but the context I said them in are important. You can't make the world stay still. It's going to evolve. Species are going to become extinct. The world is going to change. Technology is going to change. Nature is going to change. Nature is changing all the time. And so if we're going to concentrate on influencing things, we should not try to concentrate on holding them the way they are, because that's hopeless. Mm-hmm. What we should do, in fact, is to try to concentrate on changing them in a direction that we find better. The only trouble is that we is a heterogeneous collection, mm-hmm. which includes people with very different interests. Mm-hmm. I'm a citizen of the state of Vermont, and my fellow townspeople have bumper stickers on their cars that say, "Another Vermonter for global warming." Because if you lived in Vermont, you'd like it to be warmer. You know, people who own stock in companies that make air conditioning machines might be in favor of global warming. That's, in a sense, trivializing the point, which is that different people have different interests. And therefore, the struggle is not a moral one, or it's a political one. It's always a political one. And that's the most important thing you have to recognize, that you may be struggling to make the world go in one direction, somebody else is struggling to make it go in another direction, and the question is, who has power? And if there's a differential in power, and you haven't got it and they have, then you have to do something to gain power, which is to organize. And I guess my final word is organize, organize, organize.
And on that note, Professor Lewinson, thank you very much for taking the time from your schedule to be here today.
Thank you, Harry, for talking to me.
Thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.